What we found that was really surprising was that new neurons were being generated too.
Yeah.
And at that time, you know, again, this is early 80s, the dogma was that new neurons could never be generated in the adult.
I mean, literally a decades-long war in the sciences.
This was really fundamentally new,
yeah.
that neurons could be made in any vertebrate, right? And in this case, you know, with a real functional effect. Because the birds, you know, that's how they sing. They're laying down new neurons, and that's essentially the neurologic substrate, the brain substrate by which they sing.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neurosciences here at the University of Rochester, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. If you have an opportunity, give us a like and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined today by a researcher whose work has transformed our understanding of the different populations of cells found in the brain, how they interact and support each other, the underlying mechanisms of many neurological disorders, and the potential of gene and cell therapies to treat these diseases. Physician scientist Dr. Steve Goldman, who's co-director of the University of Rochester's Center for Translational Neuromedicine, is also a University of Rochester Medical Center Distinguished Professor in Neurosciences. His early research was inspired by nature, learning how songbirds create new neurons when learning new songs, and then translating that into human health, which may in fact help repair damaged neural networks in diseases like Huntington's disease. He is the recipient of many awards, including the Novo Nordisk Foundation Laureate Award and the Jacob Javits Neuroscience Investigator Award from the National Institute of Health. He also treats patients and is dedicated to training the next generation of scientists. Steve Goldman, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's a pleasure.
I have a ton of questions to ask you, and the first thing I want to dive into what has to be, you know, one of the more extraordinary things that has happened in neurosciences, the transfection of human cells into a mouse brain. Why would you do that? Just let's go after the basics here, and what have we learned from that?
Well, so we realized years back, and this is work with my wife, Mika Niedergaard, we realized that glial cells, the support cells of the brain, and those are composed of the astrocytes and oligodendrocytes. The oligodendrocytes are the myelinating cell type of the brain. The astrocytes are the support cells of neurons and their synapses. And we realized that just looking at anatomic samples, that initially, that human astrocytes were really, really different than mouse astrocytes.
Right.
Really different.
So just backing out, I mean, these cells are, they're almost like the scaffolding, right, for the big neurons.
Yep. Yep.
And people really underestimated these cells for a long time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. But there's actually more astrocytes than neurons in the brain.
Right.
And so we've traditionally thought of it as a support cell.
Yeah.
Just metabolic support. It turns out it's much, much more involved.
And they're busy putting insulation onto the neurons and things
like
that.
The oligodendrocytes are, yeah.
Oligodendrocytes.
That's, the myelinating cell type that insulates neuronal fibers. But the astrocyte is extraordinarily complex in humans, and it turns out that it subserves a lot more functions than we'd previously realized.
Yeah.
So yeah, the word glia basically means glue, and it was originally conceived of as the glue of the brain, just because nobody really knew what they did except that they seemed to support the, as you say, the infrastructure of the neurons. And then...
Well, now I have to tell you, I have 30 years in neuroscience, and I've just found out that glia means glue. So thank you for that.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So what's turned out is that it's much more than just metabolic support. You know, these cells, astrocytes have lots of fibers.
Uh-huh.
It's a very fibrous cell type. And every one of those fibers is either connected to a blood vessel or, in the majority, to individual synapses. So individual synapses throughout the brain, the connections from neuron to neuron, mm-hmm. every one of them is basically encompassed by an astrocytic fiber. And those astrocytic fibers sequester the contents of each synapse. And they control the levels of neurotransmitters going from neuron to neuron. And they control the levels of different ions that affect the excitability of neurons.
Right.
And so it turns out that human astrocytes are much larger than those of mice. And they're much more complex. a given mouse astrocyte might essentially control a couple of thousand synapses. A human astrocyte in the cortex can control 100,000 plus.
100,000 plus. Yeah.
So we realized that at a certain point, well, gee whiz, if the human astrocytes are that much more involved and are so different from mouse, what if we replace the mouse astrocytes with human astrocytes in the mouse brain?
Yeah.
And basically see what that does to neuronal function. And so this was an experiment we did about 12 years ago,
right,
and where we did exactly that. Now, we had set up these animals that we call chimeric mice years before that for the purpose of looking at myelination potential by human oligodendrocytes.
Right.
And that was a straight clinical program, which remains a clinical program,
sure,
for seeing how to put new myelin into brains of patients that have lost myelin, the white matter of the brain,
yeah,
in the setting of multiple sclerosis or white matter strokes. And at the same time, we established the basically the system and the methods, right, for making human cells.
So let me jump in.
Yeah.
Like, so the idea is that you're going to take human oligodendrocytes, glia, transfect them into a mouse to understand the mechanism by which these support cells are, yeah, really helping to repair damage in the brain.
Yeah, that's right. And to use the cells as a vehicle for repairing damage,
yeah,
right, and to take that to the clinic.
Of course,
so that was where this work started.
Now, right? What I know viewers are going to be wondering is, how does a human cell go into this very different animal system? Do you have to do some special programming to allow that cell to survive in there, or do they just proliferate?
No, they do great. So these are done in immune deficient environments, in mice that have been engineered to be immune deficient. And so we transplant these astrocyte biased, we call it, cells into the brains of these baby mice, and they again take over. And then what we found was that they act like human astrocytes in terms of being much larger and controlling many more synapses.
Right.
And so the brains end up looking very different than a normal mouse, because now you've got human astrocytes that have very different morphologies. Mm-hmm. They have very different, mm-hmm, structures. They're much larger. There's many.
And just at a fundamental physics level, are they taking up more space now in the mouse brain?
They don't seem to. It seems like they're
the number is controlled. And
yeah, the numbers are controlled. In fact, we, mm-hmm, now have good molecular understanding of how that happens. The numbers are controlled. There's probably fewer. Well, there are fewer of them than the mouse astrocytes they're replacing, because,
right,
they're controlling much larger neuronal domains.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But the fundamental architecture of the brain doesn't change. It's rather that the glial,
right,
architecture,
right,
and the relationship to neurons changes. And then the real surprise was, we thought, well, gee whiz, we've got all these human astrocytes that are controlling many, many more synapses than would normally be the case. What's that doing functionally?
Yeah, right, exactly.
And so we put these animals through a variety of cognitive tests and behavioral tests, and it turned out that they behaved much, much better, with a much higher performance level.
Yeah.
I mean, colloquially, we call them the smart mice.
So they're smarter mice.
Yeah.
They've got human astrocytes. Their neurons are
the neurons
mice
are all mouse
neurons.
Yeah. So in terms of looking at these as clinical vectors, we thought, well, gee whiz, we have these cells we want to transplant to treat a disease, but they may not act in a human brain, human to human, the way that they do in the mouse.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And so we did this experiment, which this was just published 2 years ago. We made one of these, actually dozens and dozens of these chimeric mice, quote unquote, where we did this initially with Huntington's disease as a proof of principle,
yeah,
where we took glial cells, glial progenitor cells that carried the Huntington mutation. And we use Huntington's because we're thinking of Huntington's as one of our targets, clinical targets.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we
devastating disease, really.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. So for those not familiar, Huntington's is it's a dominant disease, which is to say that half of children of a parent with Huntington's will get it, and it's invariably fatal.
Yeah,
it's only a question of when the disease comes on. And how quickly it progresses, and that's a function of the specific mutation. It's called a polyglutamine repeat expansion. But basically, the Huntington gene has a stretch of amino acid glutamine that is supposed to be, less than about 20-25 residues, amino acids, right, in length. Yeah. And sometimes it just, by a process that we're finally starting to understand, starts to increase in size over time and from generation to generation. And when it gets long enough, it really perturbs the normal cellular machinery, and right, basically the cells, right, die. Yeah. So we're trying to develop this as a means of treating Huntington's by replacing the mutant Huntington expressing glia with normal glia. It turns, right, out glial pathology is a big part of Huntington's. It's not just, yeah, neuronal. Yeah. And it also turns out that if you correct the glial pathology, it corrects a lot of the neuronal pathology because you're fixing the synapse, basically.
Right, of course. Yeah,
yeah. So we thought, okay, let's see what happens if we make a chimeric brain with all mutant Huntington expressing glia,
yeah,
human, and then put in normal human cells, right, that we want to replace them with. And so that's what we did. And so we took embryonic stem cells that carried the Huntington mutation, made glial progenitor cells from those. And so that spans about a 5-year period where we developed the methods for making these cells from embryonic stem,
yeah,
cells.
Yeah, this is a real engineering molecular engineering feat. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's allowed everything after that, basically.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so we made these mice where all the glia, the human cells, outcompeted the mouse, and now we have all the glial cells express the mutant Huntington.
Right.
And we let them grow up. And when they were almost a year old, we transplanted in normal glial progenitor cells. The healthy cells
went over the diseased. Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that basically provides the proof of principle that human cells will outcompete human.
Right.
In this case, they're doing it in the mouse, but the mouse is just the environment in which
absolutely,
we're,
yeah, yeah,
testing this. And in the setting of that work, this is an aside, but an interesting one that opens this up to a lot of disease targets. We thought, well, is this something that's specific for Huntington's? Is it specific for healthy cells outcompeting diseased? Or is there something more to it? And thinking that through, we realized that the cells that were in these mouse brains at a year were, by definition, older than the cells that we were transplanting in.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So we thought, well, gee whiz, what if it's the young cells outcompeting the older cells?
Right, right. Because they're still progenitor-like cells and they're still regenerating.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
They're still dividing. So we did this experiment, which was to take one line of normal human glial progenitor, or of embryonic stem cells,
yeah,
make glial progenitor cells from them. But we tagged the cells first genetically using CRISPR, a method for editing, yep, specific genes into the target cells. And one line was green and one line was red. Okay? And we made glial progenitor cells from both. But it's the same line.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
It's just two sublines that have different colors on them, but it's the same cell.
Right.
And then we took one of them and transplanted into baby mice to make chimeras. And the other one, we just froze.
Right.
Okay. And we waited about 9 months or so. And then we thawed out the cells that had been frozen, okay, because they'd been sitting in suspended, right, animation, basically. Once they were, you know, thawed out and growing again as glial progenitors, but now quite young, we transplanted them into the chimeric brains, into the brains that already, right, had their...
They're siblings.
It's hard to even say siblings.
Yeah,
it's,
they're right.
Right? So technically, these are isogenic.
Yeah.
Meaning it's the same cells, it's just one is younger than the other.
Yeah.
And the young cells outcompeted the older ones and kicked them out.
Right? Look at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was kind of, it was fascinating to see. But it wasn't just that the younger cells were dividing more. They were. But in that process, you know, if that was all that was happening, you'd expect some sort of admixture. But they're actually killing the older cells.
Right.
And they were developing these waves in the brain. And as those waves moved at the borders, they would just kill the older cells and just march along.
Yeah, your time is done. The youth movement's on the march.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
It was like, you know, seeing the 60s. And,
if ever there was a case well made, because it can be difficult, you know, you talk to the lay public and they say, you're working on what, mice, lab mice? Like, what? How is that relevant to anything? Why are my tax dollars being spent on this? And if ever there was a case to be made for exactly why this is relevant to human disease and that you just made it in spades, Sure. But you like, there's another animal model that you have a passion for that, that might take a little bit more explaining than the mouse, and that's the songbird, right?
Canaries.
Canaries. So you're working in canaries.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about your passion for canaries and where that came from. And again, yeah. You know, tell the folks out there why that's actually really, really important and that they should care about it.
Yeah, that's turned out to be in some ways the most direct story, if you will. Ironically, in terms of potential clinical translation.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I started working on the neurology of birdsong as a graduate student. That was my PhD thesis at Rockefeller, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was just interested in neurology of birdsong, period. I just thought it was an interesting thing.
Just
to
for
pick
the
up.
Curiosity of it. Yeah. Like basic science. Yeah. No,
very, very basic
no
science.
No necessary clinical translational part to it or anything.
No, yeah. No. I mean, at that point, you know, I was in the MD PhD program at Rockefeller and Cornell, and I just assumed I was going to take this couple year little way station and do a kind of interesting PhD and then go back to, you know, to being a straight clinician.
Yeah. You're a scientist, but you're a doc as well. Like, you're a doc at the clinical coal phase as well. And that, sure. That I think, you know, it would become clear to folks why you think the way you do because of those two hats or two skill sets that right. You have in your toolbox.
What I found as a graduate student, this was a fellow named Fernando Nottebaum at Rockefeller, was that, it was known that male birds sing and females don't, among the true songbirds. Mm-hmm. And that one category, the Ossine songbirds, learn a new song every year. And then they forget at the end of the year. And the part of the brain that they sing with is larger in males than females. And so that was all known when I started my PhD. And then I was interested in what's the cellular basis for that. And the tools back then were much more basic. I mean, this was in the early 80s. But we used a technique called thymidine autoradiography, which is now obsolete, but then was you know, state of the art 40 years ago, yeah. And found that new cells were being generated in the bird brain, in the female bird, because it was known that testosterone given to females would make them sing, and the part of the brain would increase in size.
Right? Interesting, yeah.
And we found that new cells were generated. And I did that experiment up front thinking the new glial cells or new endothelial cells, new blood vessel cells, mm-hmm. might be made to subserve this increase in size. But what we found that was really surprising was that new neurons were being generated too. Yeah. And at that time, you know, again, this is early 80s, the dogma was that new neurons could never be generated in the adult.
In an adult, yeah. In
really adult
important.
Animal, right?
Yeah. And I mean, literally a decades-long war in the sciences about whether this could be or... Yeah, so it's very...
This was really fundamentally new, that neurons could be made in any vertebrate, right? And in this case, you know, with a real functional effect. Because the birds, you know, that's how they sing. They're laying down new neurons, and that's essentially the neurologic substrate, the brain substrate by which they sing and learn a new song. So I thought, okay, this is very neat. But I also started to think, well, gee whiz, you know, this might actually have some clinical importance. Can we make this occur in the mammalian brain? And it turned out that once we knew enough about the bird brain, exactly which molecules were involved, right, and exactly what the sequence of events was at the molecular level, after you give a shot of testosterone to a female bird, why new neurons are then made and then recruited into the primary song nucleus and send fibers out to their targets, and the bird starts singing. You know, once we understood all that in the bird, we thought, well, let's take those same molecules and express them in the mouse and then rat brain.
Right.
You know, what happens? And what happened was that areas of the brain that shut down neuronal production normally at birth or around birth started making new neurons again.
Look at that, yeah.
And they started making those neurons. We did this initially in mice and rats and actually took it to monkeys as well. And in all those cases, the new neurons were being made in the area of the brain that we call the striatum, mm-hmm. which contains the motor control nuclei. And these are areas that control motor coordination.
Yeah.
And these are the areas of the brain that are affected in Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease. And the neuronal cell type specifically that is made in all the mammals that we've looked at after we turn on this process is what's called the medium spiny neuron, which is the major neuron of the basal ganglia.
Right.
And that's the cell type that is lost in Huntington's disease. In Huntington's, that's the most vulnerable cell type for reasons we're only now starting to understand, and it dies off.
Right.
And so Huntington's affects the brain entirely, but first and foremost, it hits that part of the brain, the striatum, and it kills off that medium spiny neuronal right. population. It's also the cell type that is the target of the cells that are lost in Parkinson's disease. So it's right at the nexus of these two major neurodegenerative diseases. So we thought, well, gee whiz, you know, if here we're generating these cells in the medium spiny neurons, what happens if we do that in a Huntington's model, right? And so then we got a hold of mice that express the Huntington mutation, mm-hmm. not the humanized or the chimeric mice, but just transgenic mice.
Mutant mouse.
Exactly. And then used different viral vectors to express the specific proteins.
Yeah.
One's called noggin, which keeps the cells progenitors as opposed to becoming glia. Another's called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which forces them to become
neurons. So you've used the bird brain to figure out the switches, the molecular switches that need to be flipped on the panel. And now you translate that all the way up these species with an eye to curing a human disease. I mean, it's an absolute epic journey, really.
Yeah.
And again, you have just beautiful example of how simple discovery science in an animal system can get you all the way to relieving human suffering, like at the most fundamental level. It's beautiful. You turn on these mechanisms in this female bird that's never sung.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially is not built to sing if it lives its life normally. And architecture develops and singing results.
Yeah.
So it gets at some, there's something quite fundamental about that, is there? I mean, is that something that you guys have talked and thought about a lot?
Of course,
the architecture predisposes the function?
Well, it's the molecular architecture is all there in both male and female.
Right.
And it's just one trigger is missing in the female. That's just testosterone.
Yeah,
just androgen receptor.
But this circuitry is growing up in an adult female bird.
Yep.
And then they learn to sing.
Yes.
All those, months passed.
But a male bird,
after
the season, they lose their new neurons.
Right. So it happens every year.
And then they're no different than a female in terms of the underlying architecture.
Yeah. How interesting.
So in each case, the new neurons are generated in response to testosterone, naturally in the male, artificially in the female. Testosterone induces those new neurons, and there's 10 steps involved, and maybe 12 steps.
Yeah.
But and we have a very good understanding of all those steps now. That took many years of NIH support, actually.
Yeah, it's painstaking work.
Looking at the canary, very specifically. Work that I don't know whether it would be funded today.
Which
is a different issue.
You know, I think I'm sort of hammering this point, about, from mouse to humans to human disease, from a budgerigar or a canary to human disease.
Yep.
To make that very point, really, I think this is really an important point of the work that you've done and you and Macon, your wife, have done to get to really impacting humans. But it really all comes from very fundamental
very basic
stuff
that
can be hard for people to really grok, and we have to keep telling that story.
Yeah. I mean, the Huntington's work has progressed to the point where, when we overexpress those genes, and made those proteins in the Huntington's model, the animals live longer. Their Huntington's phenotype doesn't resolve completely, but it's improved really substantially. And then when we transplant. Remember that we've got two parallel strategies here. The normal glia in, that's a substantial rescue.
Right.
We're combining them.
Right? Amazing. Yeah.
So we're replacing the glia and putting new neurons in. And basically that allows us to completely regenerate the entire striatum of the animal. We've gone at least with the protein expression strategy into monkeys as well. It works there. And so, we're just a hop, skip, and jump from being able to go
into
patients.
And once it starts working in a higher order, in our first cousins and the monkeys, we're very close to being onto a good thing. Yeah.
And this one strain of that work came directly from the canary.
Yeah.
And the other from these early chimeric mice studies, right?
Yeah.
And so these are two very, very basic lines of work.
Yeah.
The canary work, yeah, as I say, I doubt that it would be funded these days, the way that the environment has changed, and yet this is what's led to everything that that we've done.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, doing the canary work, and I was glad that you got a chance to mention Fernanda Nottebohm. Do you want to say a few words about Fernanda and how, epic the work that he did is, and what his impact on you was, and maybe some how it framed your mentorship style? Is that part of the story there?
Yeah, I suppose. Fernanda was and is, just a brilliant guy, and his strength was in sheer creativity. Right, he really was not bound at all by dogma.
Right.
By current thought at the time, in any way, shape, or form.
A real free thinker.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was his major strength. And, something that I realized and picked up on is, this is how you do really good science.
Yeah.
But by not being bound at all by what's thought to be possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And
that's a great message.
Yeah. And he was good about keeping up with the students in terms of exactly where things were with the project, but it was always from that perspective of really trying to push the limits, not being bound or restricted by.
So creativity number one.
Yeah. First and foremost.
Yeah. And do you think you've brought that? That's something
I hope
that
so.
You've brought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Knows.
Fair enough.
Yeah. No, it's not for me to judge, but I hope
fair.
So.
That's fair. So let's go back. Actually, a little bit earlier. So, PhD at Rockefeller. When did you catch the science bug? Were you one of those 6-year-olds or 8-year-olds who was looking through a microscope and catching butterflies, or is it that far back? Or
for science, yeah,
it is. Yeah.
Absolutely. I was the one setting up the chemistry set in the garage and trying to keep the house from getting blown up.
Yeah. Did you grow up in New York?
No, Philadelphia.
Oh, Philadelphia. I knew that. Sorry.
Yeah, West Philly.
Yeah, and. The academic background? Were your parents academics?
No. My parents' mother's side got out before the war.
Right.
Polish-Ukrainian Jews who got out in time.
Yeah.
And they got out substantially before, but they knew what was coming.
Sure.
And my father's side from Latvia, a little bit earlier than that. Both sides of the family, but yeah. Basically Jews who figured it was time to get out of Dodge.
Yeah.
And they had nothing. So my father was he was in the army for a long time when he got out, the tail end of World War II, then through Korea. And he was he was basically career, except I think at a certain point, especially after the Korean War, my mother said, time to get out of
time
there.
Stop.
And after that, he ran a car part shop.
Very good.
I think the Army taught him basically how to shoot and how to fix cars, and he taught me both.
gotcha. Okay.
But there was no academic background.
The Jewish communities post-war, Northeast Coast, very concentrated on getting, having their kids get into the academy
and of course.
Work, doctors, lawyers.
When I was young. And my mother, high school grad, that's it. Yeah. Both of them just got out of high school. But my mother, we would drive to, through Center City, Philadelphia, for whatever reason. We'd go through the Penn campus. And my mother said, this is a good place. You got to go here one day. And I didn't know what Penn was.
Right. Not aimed too high or anything.
Yeah. But then, years passed and I ended up going to Penn for undergrad.
Yeah. Very good.
And I was very fortunate there. Philadelphia had a program, still does, where they would pick a couple students every year and send you to Penn for free.
Fantastic.
And so that, otherwise we couldn't afford it.
Yeah. Cool. Talk to me a bit about, oftentimes, we train a lot of MD PhDs here at the University of Rochester we think of it as a very important nexus, science, and an actual real appreciation for what it means to be in the clinic, working with patients on a daily basis. And yet, I see over the years a lot of folks really struggling with that. They can't figure out which side of the equation they want to be on and that. But you've found a balance, haven't you? I mean, it seems to me, at least, you know, in observing you, talk about that balance and whether you think that's a really key component of what it is you do.
Yeah, it's always been a key component of what I've done. Yeah. But it's, you know, the environment's changed over the years. And so the kind of career that I've had, I think, was possible for people of my generation. It's less so now.
Right. Is that? What's driving that?
Well, the systems have become much more inflexible,
right.
But both on the research side and on the clinical side. I mean, I can go into detail in both, but that's kind of the bottom line. That,
yeah.
That there's less flexibility in the systems. When I trained during my clinical years, I had to go back to Rockefeller, and we had basic science courses over and above whatever we were doing in medical school.
Yeah.
And then we're expected to be working in the lab the whole time, right? You know, even if it was a couple hours a week, nonetheless, you were
in
the
lab
at
yeah.
the same time you were in medical school. And then the flip side of that, which in some ways was more impactful, was when we were in the clinical years, you know, at the same time that we were picking up more research training, when we're on the research side, we were still expected to go into the clinic once or twice a week,
yeah.
and you know, see outpatients
right.
or go on a hospital rotation, as the case may be. But and of course, we didn't know anything, right? And so it was almost silly in retrospect to have, you know, a first year PhD student who, after 2 years of basic medical school, now
coursework, yeah.
now walking around seeing patients, but because we didn't know anything. But didn't know anything in terms of taking care of patients.
Yeah, being, yeah.
Right? But what it did, it developed a flexibility in terms of mind, of thinking, that you could go from the clinic back to the research lab, back to the clinic on the same day.
Yeah, right?
and develop that flexibility flipping gears. You know,
right? They weren't dichotomous in the way that they. Yeah, and you're quite right. I see that today. They're literally two different animals mm-hmm. for these youngsters.
Yeah. yeah, and the same thing. You know, during residency, I was fortunate. So I was at Cornell for medical school, and then stayed there for internship in medicine and neurology residency, and then some neuro-oncology which was contemporaneous with my residency at Memorial Sloan Kettering. During all that time, I still was running back and forth to the lab, and I had a neurology chair then, Fred Plum was his name, who actually let me set up a little lab, right, as a resident, and I would just, from the clinical floor, go back to the lab
Very
every
good.
Day.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Speaking about flexibility, I mean, that would be hard to pull that off today, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So then the systems didn't have as many rules around them.
Yeah.
And you could do that.
Right. Yeah.
But now the on the clinical side, it's I could just go on and on about that. It's overbearing how many specific requirements both in medical schools they have to take,
right.
And on the residency side, the same thing, you know, mandatory rotations and whatnot. If the country wants physician scientists, then you have to put flexibility back in the system, because otherwise, you know, it's going to be a dying breed.
Yeah. There's one other question I really wanted to ask you. It's quite,
sure.
in some ways, a little bit unique to you in terms of guests here. The other thing that you've done is you've established businesses, very successful businesses. And I think what you've been able to do is, you know, take the work in the lab that most of us have, you know, are trained as scientists or docs, but you're also operating in this business world very, very effectively and translating that. A few words of advice to the scientists out there, like myself, who just find that a very difficult, daunting jump. What are the keys to that? How did it work?
I'm not sure I know what the keys are.
Okay.
You know, I was fortunate along the way.
I was hoping.
I don't know if there's any general rules around this kind of thing. But
yeah.
I realized that for what we were trying to do, and initially this is all around the cell transplant program.
Right.
For what we were trying to do, in terms of developing transplantable progenitor cells for transplant into people for purposes of CNS regeneration.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of thing we could get NIH support for. Not at the level that was really needed.
Because of how expensive it was.
It's just expensive.
It doesn't literally live within the kind of constraints of the grants that are available through NIH.
Not for cell therapy. I mean, NIH will fund all sorts of clinical trials, but generally they will fund the trials. But when you're talking about cost of goods for actually making cells or viruses, the case may be, that's not the kind of thing that NIH traditionally has picked up.
Right.
And so, I was hardly unique in that regard. Had to look at going to industry to be able to foot the bill for what we were doing. And initially we, so I have an appointment also at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark.
Yeah.
And initially set up shop with Novo Nordisk. They had sponsored some of, or setting up this parallel lab in Denmark.
Gotcha, yeah.
And so then their venture capital arm approached me and said, well...
They came to you. You didn't go knocking on the door saying, I have this cool technology. Are you guys interested?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So they came to me.
Yeah.
It was in part because in the U.S. before that, I had gotten one of the New York State's grants that were available at the time that were meant to be able to take stem cell technologies to the clinic.
Yeah.
And it was one of the rare grants that actually would fund, if you will, cost of goods, but for actually making cells, et cetera.
Yeah.
And of course, California has its own program, which has been a very successful one. Otherwise, very few states have had. New York had one and dropped it some years back. But we were one of the initial award recipients there, and we were able to at least get the process going.
Yeah.
And in that context, I had developed a patent portfolio around the different techniques. And I did that really out of, if you will, a defensive mode, because I realized that otherwise we might be withheld from doing what we want with some of the techniques we're developing.
Yeah, understood. Yeah.
And when we set up the lab in Denmark, Novo actually investigated, I guess, its award recipients and said, well, how have you got all these patents? And so they had their venture capital arm come to me and say, don't you want to set something up? And so they it was instructive because they then put together a small syndicate in Europe. And I guess the emphasis should be on small, because then when they came back with the amount of funding, I realized that it's not going to be enough. You know, for what we want to do, it's just not enough. So we shut it down. But by that point, we're already in the mode of thinking about, okay, this is how we have to talk to venture capital, and these are kind of the straight shot approaches, if you will, to potentially go to the clinic. And then set up a shop in the U.S. as a separate company, as a biotech, a spinoff out of U of R, and we're able to get that funded, and funded significantly, and so that allowed us to start producing cells under GMP, good manufacturing practice, that would be essentially be the transplantable
right, cells. And that's GMP facilities here in the University of Rochester.
And that was a facility that was. Funded and set up for, in part, this purpose. But it was organized by Steve Dewhurst, our current president of research here. At the time, Steve was the head of microbiology and immunology. Mm-hmm. And several of us were on this proposal to the state, but it was the same time that we had the funding from the state for the glial progenitor transplant program.
So it's interesting that you've got the state government involved, you've got private industry involved, you've got the University of Rochester, and then you've got creativity and brain power from the Goldman Lab. And there's a lot of folks that have to come together, a lot of tendrils have to come together to make this possible. Yeah. But there's a model there, right? This should be this should be more doable, I think, in the field.
It's doable in the field. It's certainly doable at Rochester. And that's been key. You know, Rochester's been wonderful in terms of enabling a lot of this. And that's also from the standpoint of flexibility.
With all that's going on with cuts to science and research in the current political environment, again and again, you hear people saying, 85% of our economy is driven, or whatever the numbers are, but they're high numbers, driven by the innovation engine that has been created in this extraordinary country where we've supported for decades now biochemical, biomedical research, physics, optics. And, to back away from that is to back away from the very thing that made this place the mecca for science.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Are you hopeful? I know you're worried. I think we're all worried. But do you remain hopeful? Do you remain optimistic about the science enterprise?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, look, so science is better than it's ever been, right?
Yeah.
And the acceleration in our rate of acquisition of knowledge has been so extraordinary. And just over the last 10, 15 years, it's just, it's a new world.
It is.
I think that's unstoppable. The kinds of impediments we're seeing to the enterprise at this point are real.
Yeah.
Right? The academic missions are being undercut. Biotech is suffering terribly at this point.
Right.
Because biotech depends upon basic academia.
Right.
What comes out of it. And pharma depends upon what comes out of biotech. So right now that entire ecosystem is being hit terribly.
Yeah.
But it'll be transient because ultimately the science progresses. Regardless.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, now it seems like it's progressing more in China and elsewhere than in the U.S.
Well, and maybe they'll have to pick up the train for the time being, at least. Yeah.
Europe is as well.
Yeah.
It's again, we have a footprint in Europe as well, and it's been remarkable how quickly we've been awarded new funding.
And they've snapped in to take up the space. And why wouldn't they? Right.
I mean,
we're giving. And again, that's the corrective, right? That's the important message to our public, is that if we step back for too long, we will lose.
We will lose
our preeminence.
It's already starting to happen, unfortunately. Yeah. And the loss of preeminence is not to Europe at this point. And in Europe, of course, it's all collaborative on some level, But with China, it's not as collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of the work that is coming out of there now, at least in my fields, is extraordinary.
Yeah.
It went from 0 to 60 over the course of
and extraordinary resources being pumped into it now as well.
Yep. Yeah. And the sheer, it used to be a common criticism that work out of China was not as creative or as innovative. That's no longer the case.
That's not the case. No, I agree.
Absolutely first rate work that's coming out of there. If the current situation continues for another couple of years, they'll be substantially ahead of us in most fields of biotech. And that includes things that are potentially malign use as well as as well as good.
Right. Yeah. Well, on that semi-hopeful note, we'll pull it to a close.
Right.
What a great pleasure to have you here, Steve,
and a great
conversation. John. Really appreciate the time.
It's fun.
Cheers.
Yep, thank you.
If you were intrigued by this conversation, like and follow us to hear more episodes of Neuroscience Perspectives from the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience.